Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. As always, please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free report, Natural Remedies So Powerful They Could Make Antibiotics Obsolete. These are the very same herbal formulas I used when I was in medical practice that made it possible for me to stop using antibiotics. And antibiotics kill 63,000 Americans every year, so get your report. Don't dilly-dally. And, of course, questions are always welcome, and you can call in at 914-338-0695. All right. Well, last week we did Show Me the Numbers, and we reviewed shocking numbers that suggested more than half of all deaths in the United States are from medical care. That would be medical homicide, or for common folk, we use the word murder. Now, today I'm going to take a close look at another number. This is infant mortality. And this number or statistic is often touted as a measure that reflects the health of our nation and the effectiveness of our healthcare system as a whole. However, I think after tonight you'll see that evidence indicates otherwise. First of all, what are we talking about? What is infant mortality? And the answer is, it is not what you think. Not at all. Now, in the United States, there's this raging debate going on about pro-life, that would be, I think, anti-abortion, and pro-choice, that would be the woman's right to choose, as it pertains to abortion. However, it will come as a shock to both camps that a pregnant woman who chooses to continue her pregnancy is facing a prenatal experience that is certainly not pro-life, and she unfortunately has little choice either as she proceeds with her pregnancy. So we'll take a look at that too. The real question here is, how many pregnancies does it take to have a live baby at 1 year of age? Or if 100,000 live births happen, how many mothers have to die and how many pregnancies have to happen? And what's being counted? What's being omitted? Could this be a cover-up? You decide. So at the end of the day, I'll also tell you what you can do naturally to tip the odds in your favor. So let's begin, as always, with the party line. This is what the doctors say. And this is a quote from the Faro Clinic, and they proudly paste it online on their site. But this is something that, I mean, you can go to the AMA, the Society for Obstetrics and Gynecology, any authority, and this is what you're going to hear. And this is also what I was told, by the way, 30 years ago in medical school. Finally, it is important to remember that there is nothing anyone does to cause a miscarriage in the vast majority of cases. Miscarriage does not happen due to lifting, exercise, sex, or stress. In rare cases, spontaneous abortions can happen repeatedly. These cases can be diagnosed, and there is treatment available. I'm not saying it's effective. Well, I'm just going to note that. There's treatment available for many of these women. Miscarriage is a natural process of cleaning out the uterus and preparing the woman for a normal pregnancy. So that is the party line. And so when I was in medical school, I was like, man, geez, I wish we could do more for these poor ladies. And so as I researched infant mortality, just in general, especially for tonight, I found that it counted babies born alive who died before the age of 1 year. That's what it is. So the baby's born alive, dies before the age of 1 year, then that is infant mortality, and that's 6.4 per thousand. And that sounds like a pretty good number. But wait, what about babies born dead? So what if a baby comes out and he's dead? Well, they don't count that. That doesn't count. Well, didn't that mother want a live birth? Is a baby any less dead if it dies after birth or 1 hour before? So these are not called infant mortality. No, they are called stillbirth. And this number, by the way, is 5.2 per thousand. So now we've got the 6.4 and the 5.2, so we'll call that 11.6 deaths per thousand. But wait, what about those pregnancies that ended between conception and 20 weeks? Let's take a look at that number. Well, wait a minute. That number is pretty darn hard to find. It is shrouded in mystery. And in many states, it's not counted. And, the CDC and statistics people, they tell the states that they really don't even want to know what that number is. However, there have been some industrious researchers who've researched into this matter. And these are standard, establishment sources. And so the spontaneous abortion rate, that's what it's called spontaneous abortion. And in your mind, then, it separates it from infant mortality. So you don't associate this with a woman got pregnant, she wanted to keep this baby, and somehow the baby died before the age of 1 year. Oh, no, no. Let's take this and put it in another category psychologically by calling it a spontaneous abortion. Now, another name for it is miscarriage. But these are deaths all the same. Now, various sources have different numbers for different groups, if you're under 25, over 40, da-da-da-da. But these deaths amount to between 125 and 400 per thousand live births. Whoa, problem over here. Let's review that medical statement again. I'll read it again for you. Finally, it is important to remember there is nothing anyone does to cause a miscarriage in the vast majority of cases. Miscarriage does not happen due to lifting, exercise, sex, or stress. In rare cases, spontaneous abortions can happen repeatedly. These cases can be diagnosed, and there is treatment available for many of these women. Miscarriage is a natural process of cleaning out the uterus and preparing the woman for a normal pregnancy. In other words, we'll break this down in English, there's nothing doctors can do to prevent miscarriage. So if you are a woman and your goal is to have a live birth, then more than 95% of the things that can happen that will cause the death of your baby, modern medicine is not positioned to prevent. In fact, it's not even interested in preventing because it's not even counting them. So you'll probably say, you mean doctors cannot help a woman improve on 95% of all the causes of death that face her fetus? Well, what's the benefit of prenatal care? Well, a lot of people are asking that question. You're not the only one. So you can imagine how defrauded a woman might feel when she's asked to submit to humiliating invasive pelvic exams, long waits in the doctor's office, 95% of the harm a fetus faces cannot even be mitigated by the medical profession, and then she gets a delivery bill for $15,000? It's a bit much to bear. So let's take a look at these numbers. Now, I've expanded these to 100,000, so everything gets the same denominator, and we can compare apples and apples. All right, so if we want to get 100,000 live births, what's going to happen? In order to get 100,000 live births, there have to be 25 dead mothers. So 25 of these 100,000 women who embark on their pregnancy is not going to make it. They're going to die. Now, we're going to talk a little later about why they're going to die and how one hospital in New York City got its maternal death down to zero, the death rate down to zero. We're going to talk about that, too. It's possible. So if one hospital can get its maternal death rate down to zero, what does that tell you about the 25 mothers who do die in childbirth, during the course of their pregnancy? So in order to get 100 live births, we're going to get 620 infants died. These are babies who are born alive, but for some reason died before their first birthday, and 25 mothers are going to die within 30 days of giving birth. So what any woman would want to know is, if I get pregnant and choose to carry my baby to term, or as long as I can carry it, what are my chances of having a live birth? And what are my chances of dying? So we know up front that her chances of dying are 25 per, we're going to find, 133,000 pregnancies. Because a lot of these pregnancies are not going to be result in live births, and only live births are counted, and all the rest are not counted. All right. So out of 133,000 pregnancies, 33,250 deaths happen before 20 weeks. These are not counted. And what causes these deaths? So we're talking about deaths that happen before 20 weeks. 20 weeks is an arbitrary cutoff point. It's important to understand this cutoff point because despite all of the progress in neonatal, that means young fetus, premature babies, intensive care units, the date at which a fetus is able to live outside of his mother's womb has really not changed that much. It's still pretty much at 23 to 24 weeks. So at 20 weeks, if a baby is born prior to 20 weeks, that is pretty certain that baby is not going to live. So these babies then are not counted as infant mortality. I would argue they should be counted because that's what women want to know. They want to know, if I get pregnant, what are my chances of having a live birth? And if it's diminished by this much, 33,250, then that's relevant. All right, so what can cause a baby to die prior to 20 weeks? Actually, it turns out there's a lot of things. Medical intervention is on the list. Now, again, these are not counted, and there has been research done, but the last research that was done on iatrogenic impact on miscarriages was done in 1985. Now, that's embarrassing, but that's the truth. Okay, so what causes these deaths? Some of them. Chorionic villus sampling. What is this? This is a special test that's done at 7 to 10 weeks gestation to determine, really to evaluate the health of the fetus. So this has no therapeutic benefit, whatever. This is simply a test to check the fetus, see how well it's doing. And if we do this little checkup on chorionic villus sampling, we can expect an increased fetal loss somewhere in the area of 3 times what it would have been had the chorionic villus sampling not been done. And this is a study done in Lancet in 1986. You can imagine why this has not been repeated. Yeah, it would be economically devastating. So keep that in mind, triple. So if you get chorionic villus sampling to check to make sure your baby is genetically perfect, you can literally triple your chances of having a miscarriage. And those are some pretty big numbers there. Next, what else happens? Well, of course, you can get amniocentesis. Now, there's an intervention. It turns out that amniocentesis increases the fetal loss from 1% to 5%. Or another way of looking at it is it can increase the fetal loss fivefold. Now, the reason that these percentages are done this way is because the probability of losing a fetus between conception and 20 weeks changes along that continuum. The longer you go on that continuum, then the less the chances are of fetal loss. So the only way to measure it is to take that point in time and do a comparison of ladies who did not get the test but met certain clinical criteria and ladies who chose to get the test and met the same clinical criteria. So literally, there's a fivefold increase in the women who elected the amniocentesis. And the cause of fetal death was that the needle happened to hit the umbilical cord, which was, like, too bad, and that the basically it came down to needle placement. But these things happen, and 5% or a fivefold increase in fetal death is just it's phenomenal. Okay, so you've got that impact on the prenatal death prior to age 20 weeks. Well, what happens after 20 weeks? Well, what happens after 20 weeks is the baby can, woman can experience premature labor. In other words, you can go into labor before the doctor feels it's a good time for her to go into labor, and you can institute therapy to delay that delivery. Or she can be pregnant and go beyond the due date the doctor estimated, and the doctor can give drugs to induce the labor, or the doctor can do a C-section because he feels the baby is overdue. Okay, so let's take the first end of that. Let's say the baby is believed to be premature and the decision is made to delay labor. Well, one way of delaying labor is to use magnesium sulfate. This, of course, depresses the mother's breathing, can depress mother and baby's heart rate, and in, of course, very sad and regrettable circumstances, result in the baby, in the death of the baby. Now, you say, what about the death of the mother? Well, this fancy accounting going here. If the mother dies, then the death of the baby is not counted as a death. Just bookkeeping practices. No particular reason given, but this is the way that is the way that it's done. So magnesium sulfate. Another thing is given is the doctor can decide labor needs to be induced and can give oxytocin, another drug that can result in death to mother and baby. And again, these deaths are not counted because if the baby dies inside the mother before being born, which is what happens with oxytocin, then it's not counted as a fetal death. And, of course, if the mother dies, then neither death is counted. So, if the baby dies, then the mother's death is not counted. If the mother dies and the baby lives, then, but dies later, the baby's death is counted. So if the baby dies, it's like the mother never exists. She's just basically erased. Now, another thing is the mother can get all the way to the hospital, get into labor, live baby, live mother, labor is progressing, and all of a sudden it appears the kid is stuck. And there's something called vacuum delivery. They literally apply what amounts to a vacuum cleaner or suction cup to the baby's head. And if you do this long enough and you pull hard enough, you can actually cause bleeding. And that bleeding can affect the baby's viability. And so it turns out that if you do vacuum deliveries, there's as much as a 5-fold increase in fetal death. And this was reported out by the American Academy of Family Practice. So we'll take their word for it. Now, again, all these deaths are not counted, because if a death happens during the delivery process but before the baby is fully out of the body, then that's not an infant death. It's something else. It's an unfortunate event. It's an accident. Maybe a malpractice suit, but not a fetal death. Now, the other thing to take a look at, which we kind of glossed over, is drugs. I always like to take a look at drugs. Drugs are very, very important. Cannot underestimate their impact. It turns out a lot of people are taking a lot of medications for a lot of reasons. And one thing we talked about in prior radio shows is taking drugs for conditions that are not life-threatening, or taking drugs to prevent something, taking drugs for a condition that you do not yet have. It turns out that these drugs are implicated and responsible for deaths during pregnancy, really throughout pregnancy. So let's take a look at what these drugs might be. First, our favorite SSRIs. These are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And some of these drugs are Paxil, Prozac, Lexapro, Celexa. All of these drugs contribute to fetal death, and that's really unfortunate. And also, there's so many women who are sexually active who are taking these drugs. Now, when I was in medical practice, I did have one person who was taking an SSRI, did get pregnant while taking the drug, stopped the drug as soon as we determined she was pregnant, and actually went on to have a healthy kid. So you can have a healthy kid, but it's definitely a chance, and it is known to cause increased fetal loss. What else? Accutane, this is a drug for acne. And as you might guess, young women who are fertile, concerned about their appearance, are more likely to resort to taking a drug for their acne, like maybe Accutane. And so Accutane can cause fetal loss. Also headache drugs, notably the wonder drugs, the more recent ones that were released in the 90s, Imitrex and Zomig, cause fetal loss. And the mechanism is their interference with the blood supply to the fetus. Then we have Crestor. This is a cholesterol-lowering medication, and it causes fetal loss. As the doctor would say, spontaneous abortion. Next, we have Effexor, another antidepressant, not an SSRI, but it is an antidepressant. And Lupron. Now, Lupron is interesting. Lupron is a drug given to treat women who have fibroids and endometriosis. Again, these are conditions selectively experienced by fertile women, people who are more likely to become pregnant. And then we have the category of stillbirth. And this is a very interesting thing about trying to track fetal death. And the way it works is if the baby dies, takes the first breath, and then dies later, it's called infant death. If the baby dies between 20 weeks and 40 weeks, it's called stillbirth. If the baby dies between conception and 20 weeks, it's called a spontaneous abortion or a miscarriage. So because these things are labeled differently, then a study that looks at each one of those, these are all classified differently. So one has to go back and then kind of reassemble all the data on these. So it really does kind of look like a cover-up, doesn't it? Next is Bayer aspirin, believe it or not. So if you're taking an aspirin a day, Bayer aspirin or St. Joseph's aspirin, either brand, it seems to be a class effect, then it's going to increase your chances of a miscarriage. Now, again, the studies have not reported out exactly what the percentage is. If you're taking Zycol, which is a newfangled medication for seasonal allergic rhinitis, big word for runny nose, that causes increase in stillbirth. And then Percordin, which is a pain pill, a narcotic pain pill, also increases your stillbirth. And then there's a drug called Agrinox, which is an aggregate of two drugs, Dipyridamole, which is a drug that's proven to be ineffective, at least it was in the 80s, ineffective for thinning the blood and preventing strokes. You can take, that's also mixed with aspirin, so you can take the two together. Hopefully it'll be more effective than the one alone. But these things all cause stillbirth. This is important to know because all of these drugs, without exception, actually one drug here, ACE inhibitors cause stillbirth, or believed to be cause stillbirth. They're arguing over that. They believe it's stillbirth, but they haven't figured out a number. So all of these drugs, without exception, are given for conditions that are just not life-threatening. But the drugs are life-threatening, similarly to unborn babies. Now, what's the deal with prevention of these things? So we know 25 women out of 133,000 who have to get pregnant to give birth to 100,000 babies, 25 of them are going to die. Well, there's this hospital in New York City called New York Presbyterian Hospital. And they said, holy cow, man, we're paying out $27 million, $50 million a year and malpractice payments, and these ladies are suing us and they're winning. You know, the ladies are dying, the babies are dying. Oh, man, what are we going to do? And so somebody somewhere in this organization said, you know what, let's focus on patient safety. Let's see if we can't give these women a safer experience. Let's see if we can't focus on improving everything in this hospital that might lead to a dead mother or a dead baby. Now, let me tell you what they focused on. They focused on drugs used to induce labor, the oxytocin, magnesium sulfate. Used to delay labor and induce labor. Then they focused on operative deliveries. That's a fancy word for that vacuum applied to the kid's head, and C-sections, which do increase maternal death when you have C-section. They also focused on discontinuing or prohibiting doctors from using misoprostol for inducing labor. Now, since they were looking at what could kill the mother, they noticed in the literature this drug was notorious for killing the mother and or baby when it was used to induce labor. So they made up their minds that they were going to prohibit the use of this drug, even though in their study they say, you know, we really weren't using this drug, but we just figured we'd make this rule, which was a really good thing because more and more doctors were using it. And then they recruited physician assistants for labor and delivery, basically took labor and delivery out of the hands of the doctors. Amazing, isn't it? So they did all of this. And what happened? It didn't take long. Only took 2 years. Their malpractice cost dropped from $25 to $50 million a year down to $2 million or less per year. Now, you or me, $1 million's $1 million, right? That's a lot of money. But to this hospital, they were spending $50 million a year. Now they're down to just $2 million a year and still falling. The most recent year that this study gave numbers for was 2008. Only $250,000 a year did they have to pay out in malpractice claims. Now, what happened to their maternal death rate? How many mothers do you think died in this hospital over this period of time? Answer, zero. Zero. Not one woman died in the course of labor and delivery at this hospital. Shocking, isn't it? How many babies died? Not one. There was one baby that did have what appeared to be some mental impairment at birth, but a year later turned out to be normal. And they had 3 years follow-up on that kid, and he turned out to be an absolutely normal kid. So we had maternal harm, zero, fetal harm, zero. And this is in a hospital that made a concerted effort to change the way they did things. They didn't spend that much more money, so they say, and they're just tickled pink with their results. So if a hospital can take a look at its procedures and eliminate this 5.4 stillbirth and eliminate the maternal mortality occurring in that period of time, then we have to really, really face the possibility that what we are looking at is homicide, is the murder of pregnant women, the murder of unborn babies. I mean the right to lifers need to get on this one. This is serious. These are women who want to have their babies, and babies are literally being snatched away from them. So let's take a look at the other another side of the coin, which is, who's at risk for, or what are the risk factors for having a stillbirth? Because what we're looking at here is out of 100 live births, we're looking at anywhere from 15 to 35, or out of 100,000 live births, anywhere from 15,000 to 35,000 fetal deaths, and they're all occurring between conception and 20 weeks. That's that particular number. There's a whole other number, which was another 11,000 if you're working on $100,000 denominator. So basically, if your doctor had zero infant mortality, if we had zero infant mortality, 95% of all the infant deaths, all the fetal deaths, would still occur, would not even be affected. Why? Because if a birth happens prior to the baby being fully born, it's not counted. And so infant mortality doesn't count 95%. More than 95% of all fetal demises are just simply not counted. So let's take a look at these situations, who seems to be at risk. And then from there we can figure out, you know, what the heck can be, what can be done. So, of course, you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul Channel at BlakeRadio.com. And please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free report, Natural Remedies So Powerful They Could Make Antibiotics Obsolete. And that's VitalityCapsules.com. And, of course, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. So I'm going to go through just a little scenario of the breakdown of how many numbers are, that we're talking about. Okay, so just to run through, it turns out you need to start out with 130,000 pregnancies in order to get 100,000 live babies. And about 32,000 of those, that's going to be before 20 weeks. They're not going to be counted. And 449 deaths are going to be after 20 weeks gestation, but before birth. These are not counted. And 620 are going to be in the first year of life. These do get counted. And, of course, about 24 maternal deaths. And these are only counted because the babies lived. So if the baby died along with the mother, then we don't count the mother's death either. So this number is severely undercounted. Now, another thing we know is there's something called, as I mentioned before, infant mortality. And the infant mortality has many causes. They've taken infant mortality and they've broken it down into 10 causes. And it turns out that of the top three, two of the top three causes of infant mortality are actually iatrogenic, in other words, doctor-induced. So the first cause is congenital malformations, deformities, and chromosomal abnormalities. Now, this cause is the first, but it's shifting, so it's losing ground to the one behind, the two behind it. So next common disorder for infant mortality is disorders relating to short gestation and low birth weight, not L4 classified. So in other words, the baby was born premature. Now, what people are not told is that the doctor, when the woman shows up and says, "Well, I'm pregnant, help me, please, I want prenatal care. Oh, my God, I'm so glad I have a doctor." So when she shows up, the first thing the doctor's going to do is say, "When was your last period?" And he's going to pick a birth date for her. Now, most women write this birth date down, and the reason they write it down is for sentimental reasons, or they want to maybe know when to have the crib ready, something like that. But what they don't understand is when the doctor writes down that date, and he picks that date, if your pregnancy goes beyond the date that he's picked, then he's going to presume you're overdue and maybe do a C-section. But if he's picked the wrong date, maybe he's picked a date that's way too early, then he's going to do a C-section at a time when it could endanger your baby's life and it could cause the baby to die. And that happens a lot more than what we would like to admit. So this is how it goes. Lady shows up. "I'm pregnant." Doctor says, "You're due 30 weeks in the future." So let's say she shows up at 10 weeks. And she gave him, she knew, she kept her calendar, she knew exactly when her last period was, and she knew exactly the night she got pregnant. I mean, she could tell her doctor everything. All right, so what happens? The doctor says, "Oh, let's do an ultrasound." So he does an ultrasound. The ultrasound does not agree with the date the lady gave him. Okay, so then he does another ultrasound. That ultrasound doesn't agree with the first ultrasound or with the dates the lady gave him. So now he's really scratching his head. And then, of course, the answer is to do yet another test. If the first two aren't reliable, what? Do another one. A lot of times, doctors will even average the dates of all these three tests or four tests. But research has shown that the most accurate measure of a woman's due date is her own statement as to when her last period is. There's nothing more accurate. There is no ultrasound more accurate. There is no public exam a doctor can do that's more accurate. There's no more accurate indicator. So, nevertheless, many doctors having done these tests to justify them, so you pay attention to the results, which are unreliable, and then you end up doing a C-section at a time when the baby is premature as opposed to when the baby is actually due. And so this is the second leading cause of death for infants. What's the third leading cause of death? This is a shocker. This is a shocker. Sudden infant death syndrome is number three in terms of cause of infant mortality. This blows me away because what's the cause of sudden infant death syndrome? Vaccination. That is That's shocking, and that's really appalling. And even if you read the vaccine package inserts, they will tell you sudden infant death is a side effect of vaccines. So this is just, that's a real jaw dropper. So of the 6.4 infants that are counted in infant mortality, approximately 3 are heavily influenced by and responsible or caused by medical intervention, a.k.a. Medical homicide. So this is really just totally, totally unfortunate that women are walking into this. All right, so what can be done? We can't just ignore this. Give these ladies a little bit of help here. Well, first of all, you have to take a look at what is really going on and which women are at risk for these miscarriages. And there are a lot of things that in the literature say, well, this, we think this, we think that, but they can't put a number to it. Okay, so they think that diabetes increases miscarriage. They think that overactive or underactive thyroid increases miscarriage. But again, literature fails to provide any numbers on that. But what the heck, we'll take the word for that, but we just don't know. Then infection. This is very interesting. Vaginal infection, including bacterial, and they say viral, parasitic, fungal, or sexually transmitted diseases. They're throwing all those in there, but the only ones that, one that you really need to watch out for is bacterial vaginosis. Bacterial vaginosis is just a bunch of bacteria, basically lactobacillus, chief among them, present in the vaginal tract. So what they did was they took several thousand ladies in West Philadelphia, a poor neighborhood, not that that matters, but just in one particular geographic area. And they found that these ladies who had bacterial vaginosis, a very high count, had 2.4 times the average risk of a miscarriage. We don't know what the average risk was. They didn't tell us. They said it was 2.4 times for these ladies. All right, high count. Then they took ladies who had no, same population, who had no bacteria in their vaginal tract at all, clean as a whistle, and their chances of having a miscarriage was also 2.4 times the national average. So in other words, having bacterial vaginosis did not increase the risk of miscarriage. However, if you treat it with clindamycin, which is a drug of choice, then you have an increased chance of having a deformed baby. Right, that is right. So bacterial vaginosis, if anyone offers to treat it, politely decline. And these other infections, viral infections, for example, they don't test for viral infections during pregnancy. So you toss that one out because your doctor's not in a position to test for that. Parasitic, there's only one parasitic infection down there during, in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, but it's not clear that that increases miscarriages. So the rest of these, of this statement, fungal, sexually transmitted diseases, there's not a lot of support for. All right, what else? Age. Age is a whopper. If you are under 35, then your chances of miscarriage are 12.5%. If you're over 40, your chances of miscarriage are 39%. So just women just knowing that, they could choose to maybe have their kids at a younger age. Smoking or drinking alcohol increases your miscarriage rate. So you can quit cigarettes or quit alcohol. They say using cocaine or other illegal drugs. Again, you have to be very specific about that. The situation is we do know that cocaine can increase miscarriage rates. We don't know is if it correlates with other things. So like people who use a lot of cocaine may have other things going on that would reduce their viability. And environmental toxins like excessive exposure to lead, mercury, organic solvents. And this, by the way, if the husband or the father of the baby is exposed to these, that can increase miscarriages as well. That was an interesting finding. And then low levels of folic acid. Here is a biggie. They did a study of ladies, and it turns out that if you took a bunch of ladies who were low in folic acid and you took the miscarriage rate, it was twice what it was in a similar group of ladies whose folic acid was replaced or who were supplemented. And they also looked at woman who had low folic acid versus woman who had normal folic acid. And again, 50% difference. So what we're saying is, or what they're saying, is if you have 133,000 women who are getting pregnant, and that number of 32,000 there that are just having miscarriages, if these ladies have normal folic acid levels, you can potentially cut that down to half. In other words, you can take this 33,000 fetal death and turn it into at least an additional 16,000 live births on the other end. That's absolutely huge. And that's a bigger increase than even eliminating the 620 infant deaths. So the biggest impact on helping these women with their health can be found, or helping the babies, can be found by influencing this number, which is not even measured, this number, which is spontaneous abortion, that's the term used for it, but impacting the death between conception and 20 weeks has 95% greater potential impact than impacting death from that point forward. And that's the real rub here. So when you don't count those deaths that occur from conception all the way to birth, all those in utero deaths, then you're covering up any death that occurs as a result of a medical procedure or any death that occurs as a result of medication a person is taking. And so this is really just incredible that, you know, we have this statistic, infant mortality, and what it's actually doing is drawing our attention away from what really can be done to help mothers and babies be more helpful, and encouraging the, as you say, wanton, unrestricted murder of the next generation, which is, I find it really just shocking, just amazing. So what else you can do? So you mentioned stop smoking. Obesity has an increased risk of miscarriage, but who's going to lose 30 pounds overnight, right? So we'll leave the obese ladies alone and see if there's something else can be done here. Well, if you're going to be obese, you can have your babies before age 35. That's a good help. The next thing is coffee. Drinking more than 2 cups of coffee a day can double your fetal loss. So what does that mean? It means if you're over 40, you're already looking at a 39.7% fetal loss rate. You add 2 cups of coffee or 3 cups of coffee a day to that, you can double that to 81%. Or 80% fetal loss. That's huge. And so I think many women, if they knew, would be willing to cut their coffee down to, say, 1 cup a day, wouldn't they? Yeah, that's reasonable. And what else can they do? Like I said, don't treat your bacterial vaginosis because you're exchanging no risk for fetal deformity, so don't do that. Next is the folic acid thing. Taking folic acid, I mean, there is no better sale out there than that. Taking folic acid not only reduces your fetal loss by 50%, but you lessen your chances of hypertension, of spina bifida, and it's really great. How much folic acid? 400 micrograms of folate is what's recommended. Now, medical literature and the, I was in medical practice and I had this big drive. Eat citrus fruits to get folic acid. There's no folic acid in most citrus fruits. How come? Because folic acid diminishes from the time the fruit is harvested and shipped to the store and gets to the shelf. So if you're eating citrus fruit and you're not pulling it off the tree in Florida or California, then there's likely not any folic acid in your citrus fruit. So what can you do? The answer is beans and greens. Beans have lots of folate in them, and so do greens. So that's worth doing. And also getting a supplement of folate. You can use folic acid if you can't find folate, but the number is 400 mcg micrograms. And if you double that, guess what? It's not going to be harmful. There were reports out that excessive folic acid or excessive folate caused deformities, but those have actually all been disproven, believe it or not. They actually took it upon themselves to do research and disprove that. And that came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2002. Well, we're pretty much coming up on the end of the hour here. We have a few minutes, though, if someone would like to ask questions. But I'd like to say that the prenatal care situation is really, it's absolutely shocking. And the point of intervention in terms of having more healthy babies is not infant mortality, but is influencing the spontaneous abortion rate. And as they showed at Presbyterian Hospital in New York, once they took a look at it, once they looked at where the issues were, and they made administrative changes and instituted protocols, they were able to actually eliminate these deaths. And that's actually my position with pretty much all of hospital-based homicides, that they can be eliminated. And this is what makes them homicides, is that they are preventable. And these deaths are predictable, these deaths are expected, and these deaths are avoidable. And so it is just simply a matter of medical homicide. Now, next week, we have next week's topic all lined up for you. Next week is organic food. It's organic, but is it healthy? And I decided to do that topic because so many people, I get calls and I'm working with different people, and they believe that they're eating something organic, and so it's got to be healthy. And the answer is not necessarily. So next week we're going to talk about organic food and how it might actually be undermining our health and what you can do instead and how you can rely on other indicators that might let you know the food is healthy, or indicators in addition to or above and beyond the designation of organic. So that is what's going on for next week. Now, I have to identify my station here. You are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. And please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free report, Natural Remedies So Powerful They Could Make Antibiotics Obsolete. And that's VitalityCapsules.com. As always, we welcome your calls and questions. The number here is 914-338-0695. We have about, we could have 10 more minutes. Let's see, what else did I want to tell anyone? That's really about it. It's very, very, it is shocking that we have a number like infant mortality distracting us from what may really be something we actually can do. No, maybe. We know to be something that we really can modify, we really can influence in terms of improving outcomes for pregnant women, for their babies, even for the country. But instead, what we do is focus on a statistic that doesn't reflect the magnitude of the problem and leave women, children, and the next generation quite vulnerable. Okay, let's see. We have a question here. Let's see if I can click here. Okay, 8952, you're on the air.
Jennifer, this is Wayne Michaels. How are you?
Hi, Wayne.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
I really don't have one. I just want to encourage you and thank you so much for your efforts and work. And you taking a stand for the truth, hon, against the medical profession. God bless any and everybody like you. And, you know, you're so rare as me standing for the truth against what I stand. It's a rare breed and a blessing from God Almighty. I believe that. And I just wanted to encourage you and thank you.
Oh, okay. You're welcome.
Have a great day.
I think that that's really a good point that people really need to just get out there and, you know, I just sit around and think about these things. And I think if more people would set aside time just to think, it's amazing the things you can think about. All right, so we have 7397. You're on the air.
Hi. I was looking at some of the stuff on Dr. Carley's website, and she had mentioned subacute pansclerosing
encephalopathy. Mm-hmm.
Encephalitis, thank you. Anyway, I had picked up a PDR, the Guide to Drug Interactions, Side Effects, and Indications.
Yep, my
and it
book.
Yeah, I got it because of you. anyway, it mentioned under that disease that it was caused by one of the side effects for the MMR injection was that.
Right.
So anyway, she has mentioned that subacute, well, I'll let you say it, but anyway, she had mentioned that it actually is autism. And, yeah, I'd just be interested in your comments.
Oh, okay. Actually, that is an area of hot discussion. So the question is this autism? Is this measles encephalitis? What really is it? Because what's happening is many of these conditions are being renamed to obscure their common origin. So in other words, measles might actually simply be a form of autism, or autism might actually be a form of measles. The same as tonight's topic, which was infant mortality. When an infant dies at one time, it's called infant mortality, and another time it's a stillbirth, and still another time it's a spontaneous abortion, and still another time it's a miscarriage. By renaming this several different names for the same thing, it obscures the common reality and prevents people from formulating a common strategy and prevents people from even coming together because they don't think they have the same problem. Oh, I have measles. Oh, my son has, you know, subacute pansclerosing encephalitis. Oh, geez, well, mine has meningitis. Oh, well, mine's got polio. Well, Jesus. Well, all four of us have to go work on our separate problems when really it may all be one name for the same thing. So what I would encourage you to do is to take this name and go online and Google synonyms for it, and you would be shocked at the list that you're going to find. And then when you find the synonyms for it, I would encourage you to look up those synonyms and to find other groups with a common concern and to work with them. Because if people can understand that any one disease usually has at least three, usually five different names, it splinters things up so people don't understand that they have the same thing. And they don't understand the commonality, they don't understand the progression, and it leaves them confused and defenseless. And so you have to not let yourself get caught up in what I call the name game. Hope that answers that question. I think it's important for people to really, you know, go get a medical book and start reading it. If it's a word you don't understand, look it up. And, you know, sort through this stuff. And after a while of reading, it might take 200, 300 pages, but you'll start seeing that things repeat themselves. And in order to give the appearance that there's this big, huge body of knowledge, one actually is really only one body of knowledge. That body of knowledge says, I won't say one body of knowledge, one strategy. And that strategy says, find a condition with mortality of X, give drug, which is even more dangerous and causes death at X over 2, in other words, in a shorter period of time, and then convince the person that they would have died even sooner than not taking the drug. And that's basically the whole, that's the whole strategy for whatever condition you might decide to encounter. So if you look at it as one strategy, that makes it a lot simpler and a lot easier to grasp, so you don't have to do all this sorting. We have one more question. Hi.
Yes.
9382. Yep. Yeah.
Hi, Dr. Daniels. This is Miriam. How are you?
Hi, Miriam. How are you doing?
Good. Just want to encourage you. I enjoyed your show immensely. I do have a question. I had sent you an email about Dr. Gosnell. Remember that man? That was that clinic that was killing babies?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now, would those murders be listed under the infant mortality rate? And in the two-part question, why do they allow clinics like that to continue, you know, without, you know, why do they allow them, why are clinics like his, which kill babies, allowed? And would Dr. Gosnell's murder of late-term baby abortions be listed as infant mortality?
Okay. The answer is no, they would not be listed. And the reason they would not be listed is because he did not report the babies as being born alive. Now, had the babies been born alive and documented as being born alive, they would have been listed. That's one
How does a baby get born not alive?
Oh, stillbirth. The baby can die maybe at 38 weeks gestation before he's born. And then at the time of delivery, the baby is not breathing and doesn't start breathing. The baby is dead at birth. One cause of that is the drugs used to induce labor. Another cause of that is the drugs used to delay labor. So all these deaths due to administration of medication are concealed because those deaths are not counted as a matter of administrative protocol.
So when a woman does have an abortion, in fact, that is murder.
When you say in fact, you mean if she elects to have an abortion. I want to terminate my pregnancy. Is that what you're talking about?
Right, in general, is abortion murder?
I have not included that in these statistics. So I didn't look at those numbers in these statistics.
I'm just asking in general.
It's not classified as murder. Because even if a woman is pregnant, she wants to continue this baby, this pregnancy, and the doctor murders the baby by administration of medications, that is not counted as murder. So at no point, under any circumstances, any way, anyhow, is it allowed in the system of vital statistics to count any baby or any human that is terminated prior to 20 weeks as a death. It's not even allowed to be counted as a death. Statistically, it's not measured as such. And so what I'm saying is not making that measurement not only allows, let's say, if you're against pregnancy termination, but it allows a whole secondary wave of criminality, which is the medical system itself can engage in practices that increase the death rate of unborn babies in women
mm-hmm.
who actually wanted these babies and, you know, went through great lengths maybe to get pregnant or to, you know, continue the pregnancy. And they think they're getting life-saving prenatal care when actually they're getting, you know, the murder 101 treatment.
And no ramifications, right?
Oh, no, none whatever, because this is not even counted as a death statistic.
Mm.
There can be no ramifications because it's not counted.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's really, it's amazing. Okay, we are at 6 o'clock, top of the hour. Thank you very much, and tune in next week for It's Organic, but Is It Healthy?
Make believe.